Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. In the aftermath of the market turmoil yesterday and anticipation of market turmoil today, of course, the Federal Reserve is meeting today. The political candidates are live on the air talking about the economy. Joe Biden and John McCain are both talking this morning. We'll have more details on the political fallout from the markets a little bit later on in the program. We're just talking about General Motors rolling out an electric car today, the Chevy Volt. You would think that in a hot, flat, and crowded world, the presence of an electric car would be a positive thing. But Tom Friedman, who titled his latest book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, wants companies and institutions to react strategically to the green revolution and not simply be reactive. Tom Friedman now joins us by phone. Tom, thanks so much for being with us on the show.
Great to be with you, John. Thanks so much. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while. It's so great to talk to you. And, of course, you know, you've rocketed to the to the pinnacle of the universe since the last time we've talked. But enough about that. The days of a subprime planet are over, you write. A planet we could own for no money down, where there were no interest payments until sometime far into the future, and all the true costs were hidden. Now, that is a great prescription. We could be talking about GM there, but we could also be talking about the entire U.S. economy. What's a subprime planet?
Basically what I was talking about, John, was the United States, but as a metaphor for the larger problem we face. You know, my book is really, it kind of masquerades as an energy environment book, but it really is a book about America. And the kind of meta-argument of the book is that we've kind of lost our groove as a country. It has to do with a lot of things. It's post-9/11. It's the end of the Cold War, having lost our big competitor, the Soviet Union, and the edge that comes with that. And it's the fact that our government doesn't work anymore. It can't solve any big multi-generational problem. And the argument I'm trying to make in the book is that, you know, the world's biggest problem is it's getting hot, flat, and crowded. America's big problem now is that, you know, we've lost our groove, and I think we get our groove back as a country by taking the lead in solving the world's biggest problem.
That's really what
the argument is.
So then if GM rolls out an electric car today, you would say what really needs to happen is not just one company introducing another product, but it needs to work in tandem with all sorts of institutions, government, private sector, public sector, and we need to see that the real cost of production of that car is in the price. How do we do that?
Well, you know, you're definitely on the right track as far as I'm concerned, which is that I think it's great that GM is rolling out the Volt. God bless them. It's a little late, but better late than never, and hopefully it'll inject some life and opportunity back into GM. But it seems to me that what we need is, it's often, people ask me, like, what I think about Boone Pickens' plan for building all these turbines by himself, and that's
wind energy. He calls us the Saudi Arabia of wind. Anyway, go ahead.
Exactly, and I think that's also like a good sign, like the Volt. But what we need, basically, is an economy that is reshaped, a market that is reshaped around the incentives, both the price signals, the standards and regulations, so GM won't just have one Volt, so a billionaire named Boone Pickens won't just go off and build some wind, but so that we stimulate hundreds of thousands of innovators and hundreds of thousand garages to try 100,000 things around green energy, 100 of which will be promising, 10 will be great, and 2 will be the next green Google and the next green Microsoft, because I believe ET, energy technology, is going to be the next great global industry.
So, Tom, essentially you argue that the priorities are upside down, citing an example of the pet food companies in this country spent more on research and development last year than U.S. utilities did. How do you create those incentives to switch those priorities?
Well, you know, it's only through the market. I'm a capitalist. I believe the American marketplace is actually the greatest innovation engine God ever created. This combination of markets, venture capital, research universities, and national labs. It's a great thing we have here. But markets have to be shaped. They have to be shaped with the right price signals, a gas tax, carbon tax, et cetera, have to be shaped with the right incentives for clean power. And right now, the market signals that still dominate our energy market aren't to produce ET. The market signals are there really to support the fossil fuel industry, and that's what ultimately has to be changed.
Well, to make those kinds of broad strategic strokes, I would imagine, is going to be really, really challenging in an environment where you're reacting to crisis after crisis. I mean, yesterday the Dow fell 500 points. The candidates today are saying, oh, we're going to study this, we're going to react to this, but it's very hard to step back and do big strategy in this kind of an environment.
John, I couldn't agree with you more. What makes me weep so much about this crisis is precisely the fact that we do need a change in price signals. You're not going to get strategic investment at scale, and this is a scale challenge, the ET, the energy technology revolution, without a reshaping of the price signals, without at least someone coming along and saying, well, I can't put a gasoline tax or a carbon tax on in this environment, but let's put a floor under it. You know, let's say gasoline isn't going to fall below $100 a barrel or whatever. Even that's probably next to politically impossible in the current environment.
Wow. Well, you know, you are one of the writers in the history of the world who can describe women in Indonesia as like trees and get away with it.
And Tom, let me warn you, this is one of John's very favorite points of your book.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, if I tried to do that, I would probably be, you know, dragged out of the studio. But you explain the argument why raw labor exported by Indonesia in the form of maids is like the way they export trees.
Well, you know, the anecdote in the book really comes from seeing all these Indonesian maids in an Abu Dhabi airport, wondering who they were at first, and how come there were so many of them. And an Indian man I was standing with was explaining to me that, you know, unfortunately, you know, Indonesia was in the business of exporting 350 maids, which was the number of these young women on our airplane, rather than, you know, one high-tech educated worker. And I made the analogy that it's a bit what goes on with their timber industry, that because they are unable to add much value in Indonesia itself, what they do is chop down 100 of their beautiful trees, export them into China. China then turns them into furniture and wood products with much more value add, and then exports them to the world. And the point I was making is if Indonesia could do that, if it could actually capture all the value from that tree, it would just need to export one tree rather than 350, just as if it could educate its people, it would only need to export, you know, one educated, you know, technology worker rather than 350 uneducated young women.
Well, it's a nice argument, except that if Indonesia gets into finished goods, we still lose the forest because now there are more people chopping down trees.
Yes and no. It really depends because basically, you would need many fewer trees to build higher value add. And at the same time, the more you educate your population, the more people you can actually get off the farm not having to chop down trees at all.
If the U.S. is to seriously retool its labor force for ET, environmental technology, how much time do we have to accomplish such an enormous task?
You know, one of my favorite lines on this subject, John, is from the late and great environmentalist Dana Meadows. And whenever she was asked a similar question, she'd always say, "We have exactly enough time starting now." And I really believe that. And the nice thing, in fact, not just the nice thing, the great thing about the ET industry as opposed to the IT industry is that ET, energy technology, has a big blue-collar, what they call green-collar element. So many homes are going to have to be retrofitted in terms of insulation. So many solar panels will be able to be installed on people's roofs. To build a solar concentrator project like is on the drawing board for outside Phoenix today, you're talking about between 1,500 and 2,000 construction jobs, as much steel as the Golden Gate Bridge. So what excites me about the ET revolution is that it cuts across the entire economy from the lower skilled manufacturing and blue collar jobs, green collar jobs, right up through, you know, inventing the new, or reaching the newest frontier in photovoltaics.
Although, you know, the Chevy Volt's going to cost $40,000. The price of photovoltaics is pretty high, pretty steep at this point. Are you saying we're going to accomplish this creation of new industry without the demand pull of consumers buying stuff that's energy efficient?
No way, no how. And you're exactly right, John. And that's why, you know, what I'd love to see is two things. One is every state government and the federal government go out and put in an order for Chevy Volts for their fleet. use the buying power of the government to buy power, to drive down the cost of these new technologies, and at the same time create a law that will give anyone a substantial tax write-off if they buy a plug-in electric car. You got to create the demand out there that will pull these technologies down the cost volume learning curve till they get to the China price, the price that allow them to scale in India and China.
I guess if you wrote a book called Hot, Flat, and Crowded, and everybody reads it like everybody reads your previous books, you can say that you're advising everybody, but are you working for any of the campaigns?
You know, I don't at all. Both of them, we sent actually a copy of the book to every member of the Congress and the Senate. Everyone's got it. I'm an equal opportunity person in this regard. I'll talk to anybody who's interested in talking to me about promoting these ideas, but I don't work for anybody.
Do you detect a difference between the McCain campaign and the Obama campaign regarding this broad agenda that you've laid out?
Well, you know, I was excited about this campaign initially, John, because I thought that we had two green candidates. I don't feel that anymore. I think John McCain's gone off the wagon with his call to eliminate the gasoline tax over the summer, which only would have increased driving, increased consumption, and driven up the price of gasoline. He failed to vote for any of the renewable production and investment tax credits for wind and solar. And lately, he's landed on the mantra of drill, baby, drill.
What about Obama before we go?
Obama, I think, is stuck with his program about renewable energy. I'd still like to see him talk about it more forcefully and energetically, but I think he stayed on the wagon.
Well, there's a great takeaway. Tom Friedman criticizing the greenness of the candidates as we get close to the election. Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, author of Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Appreciate it, John.